When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a huge victory in Ohio. Good on you, Buckeyes. Last I saw, it was like a 70-30 whipping of issue one. You know, the special election that was banned by the Republicans until there was something on the November ballot that they didn't want. Yeah, went down in flames, and good. And this is a huge opportunity. And this is where my mind goes into this place where this is a big opportunity to take this and move it forward, to take this and to go, hey, you know, momentum, you know, as a sports fan, I like to talk about momentum, but this is big. Last I saw 70-30, that is in politics, that is a major, major whipping. So good on them. Now, here's the thing. This is good for Democrats, I think. And you know, maybe Republicans have gone a bit too far. You think? you know, maybe they've gone too far in all of this. And what's frustrating to me is I was reading the Wall Street Journal today. You know, the newspaper of the investor class. And here you have in the newspaper of the investor class. They asked the question, you know, why Democrats lost Iowa, and it, you know, they go into all of the racial stuff. You know, white rural voters have turned the political battlegrounds into a Republican stronghold, putting it even further out of Democrats' reach. And you go, you know, there's a reason for this, and a huge part of it is the fact that our media structure is the way it is, because, you know, stoking this divide that they continue to keep, you know, pushing out there, you know, because it's the white racist versus, you know, the blacks and them, because that's the horse race for them. But Democrats really haven't helped themselves either, because look, you have the dividing line, you have the investor classes idea, the wealth classes idea of how to keep people pitted against each other and eating each other. And they keep throwing that out so that, you know, you look at Iowa and you go, yeah, it's because Iowa's white. That's the reason they've turned to Republicans. And that's not entirely accurate. And we found that out last October into November when we did our Working Class Heroes radio tour. And we went through the entire state of Iowa and we talked to people. And, you know, the reality is people are angry. People are struggling. People are having a tough time. So when I see this article by Fareed Zakaria, you know, the liberal over on CNN, that's what I'm told. This opinion piece that America survived the China shock. There's still the Trump shock, where he goes into this. And you know, I got to read this because it's really just, It's again, it's one of the reasons why Democrats, well, it's why liberals have lost the working class of this country. Zakaria writes, for years, U.S. economic policy has been greatly shaped by the idea of the China shock, The term, coined by three economists in a 2016 paper, captures the widespread belief that trade with China resulted in the deindustrialization of significant parts of the United States and the loss of huge numbers of manufacturing jobs. There's no widespread belief. It's what happened. You know, you can't go, oh, no, someone, they believe it. But, you know, no, that's exactly what happened. Corporate America said, what? Cheap, exploitable labor? Pew, we're gone. He goes on to say it fueled much of President Donald Trump's trade policy and President Biden's new industrial policy, both premised on the notion that China presents a serious challenge to the United States' economic position in the world. It does. Sorry. He goes on to write, it is increasingly clear that that challenge has been overcome. The other disruption to the American system, the Trump shock, has not. And now he's making the argument that, you know, hey, everyone was worried about China and the job losses. And, you know, it's all better now. It's all better now. We fixed it. It's all better. You know, and he points out in the rest of the article how China is struggling because, you know, their GDP is not keeping up, employment's going through the roof. And he also makes the argument that if it wasn't China, it'd be someone else. We would have exploited other cheap labor. We would have let corporate America go and exploit. And this is the kind of stuff that infuriates me, because his premise is, you know, it wasn't a big deal. Go to Iowa. You know why the newspaper of the investor class is trying to keep that racial tension there? Because they know that if Biden's policies work, if Bidenomics works, and we actually, I don't know, reshore manufacturing, we bring those factories back, that in every community we went through, there was the skeleton bones of, and the broken lives that are the result of an empty factory. That's why. And it's because of elitists like this who say dumb stuff like this. And we're part and parcel to helping that happen. Look, NAFTA, yeah, birthed under Reagan, fully negotiated under H.W. Bush, but signed under Clinton. And now you go, but, you know, he did add the environmental and the labor protections. Yeah, but they were about as useful as an aged dog with no teeth. It still happened, and the losses happened, and the communities were torn apart. And we went into a lot of these places, not just in Iowa, but in Ohio, Ohio's, you know, sadly lost its mind over years. In my state of Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, and in Michigan, we went through these places. And in town after town, their identity was stripped away. And the reason I'm such a big supporter of Joe Biden right now, he understands it. Bidenomics, whatever you want to call it, is about undoing 40 years of neoliberalism and bringing back the manufacturing jobs that created the American dream, that gave people the opportunity to work hard, play by the rules, and yes, get ahead. To be able to live a life of purpose, to be able to live a life of dignity, to be able to live a life with respect, and being able to look in your children's eyes and go, you know what, I know you're never going to be hungry and you're going to have better opportunities than I have. And the sad reality is parents today can't say that, because those pathways into the quote-unquote middle class have been railroaded, have been roadblocked. And by whom? Well, think the newspaper of the investor class. Think all of the right-wing media who keeps feeding outrage candy daily, focused solely on the Trump race. Instead of saying, look, you know, people really are struggling. When we went through Iowa, you know, here's the reason Iowa moved from a solidly moderate Democratic state to an, oh my God, crazy right-wing state, is because when those factories left, the unions had nothing left to do there. So they left. There were no jobs. There were no opportunities. And people were struggling, and there was nobody there to help them. and all of those things that right-wing radio feeds them, that, you know what, in those inner cities, they all get welfare, they all get SNAP programs, they all get healthcare, they live high on the hog. The hood is Club Med. Living in the hood is like living in a resort. They got swimming pools and you name it. And it's not reality, but you can play on these fears. Someone's getting something I'm not, and I'm struggling, and man, the right plays on this. And now you finally got a president who's going, you know what? We're going to bring that dignity back. We're going to bring that matter of respect back. Those places that used to be something, used to be known for something, used to stamp their name on something. I did this. Understand, you know, when I talk about Buy American policies, it's not just the economics of it. That's a huge part. It's about having the jobs here and having the economic activity here, but it's also about the pride. The pride people take in the work that they do and putting their name on something and saying, you know what, I do this. My building trades friends are the most obnoxious in this category. You can't drive through a town with them without them going, I did that, I did that. And that is a great thing. But you go back to the 80s and then the 90s, and what happened? And into the 2000s, we lost millions of productive, respected manufacturing jobs. Jobs that were not only supporting a family, but supporting an identity, giving people dignity and self-confidence and self-respect. And we did away with that because why? Simple. More for rich people, more for the shareholders, more. And not the Gompers, the AFL founders' definition of more, you know, more of the good things in life, more time for our family, more time for learning, more time for childhood, more time for better opportunities to pursue the better avenues of our lives and not the negatives, more leisure and less vice, more education and less, you know, prisons, that kind of stuff. Whereas when the billionaire class goes, they want more. Well, they want the last can of beans in the cupboard. And this is where there's a moment here for Democrats in this election in Ohio, because Republicans went way too far in trying to consolidate their power. There's an opportunity to reach these people and say, look, what Biden is doing and reshoring manufacturing is going to give us opportunities. It's going to give us a way forward. Now, as far as the Trump shock goes, yeah, you're going to have to deal with that. And we will. But here's the thing. And I've said this a million times, and I'll say it a million times more. Every person who voted for Trump may not be a racist, a homophobe, or a misogynist. They may not be. Now, I look at my family, who are all those things, but that never got them to vote. That never got them to register. That never got them to get up and on that Tuesday and go cast their ballot, ever. What got them to do that and to support somebody who they, in any normal time, would know as a con man is because they bought that he was going to bring that pride, that dignity, that community back. He was going to bring those factories back. He was going to turn on those machines and get those union jobs back into people's lives so that they could support their families. They could keep a roof over their head, food on the table, vacations, college opportunities, you name it, retirement with dignity. That's what they bought. And if Democrats wanted to get the working class back, that's what they've got to sell. And not just sell it as a product, but actually do it and then sell it. And I think Biden's doing a lot of that. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, big outcome in Ohio. I saw that today, which I thought was great. Instead of Ohio, it's Ohio, because this is big. It's big news. I was worried. I was a little bit worried. People were going to stay home, not really understand how important it is. But the fact that Republicans who were against who banned special elections then decided we're going to hold a special election. rules don't apply to us. We're better than that. Anyway, let's get some thoughts from Kurt. He's in Akron, Ohio. Kurt, thanks for taking time for us, man. What's on your mind?
Hey, and good evening. And yes, I voted no. And yay, it failed.
Yeah, look, I was a little concerned. You know, at the end of the day, it's so simple it can be complicated, and it could get people all riled up and go, no, we're going to stop this one thing without understanding it. It cuts both ways. So look, I'm thrilled to see the voters of Ohio came out and did the right thing.
And you know, it's funny because I knew it was simple, but of course I was educated in it. But you know, I was having people ask me today, what exactly does all this mean, these advertisements that they're putting out on TV the last week? They're so confusing. I don't know whether to vote yes. I don't know whether to vote no. And I basically just spoke about it. You know, like, if you want to have simple democracy, which is what we have now, and I mentioned the 44 out of 88 counties in order to put something on the ballot is at stake, and then your simple majority of 50 plus 1 versus 60 is at, you know, that's what's at stake. You know, I just mentioned the numbers, you know, and then they go, well, now you convinced me. I'm voting no. So I convinced a few people to go vote no today. So,
well, good on you.
At least, so basically, it comes down to, we don't need to complicate the simple. And, you know, just for that matter, abortion, yeah, I know this is all about trying to defeat abortion in November, and it very well may be defeated in November. I don't know. I plan to vote yes on that abortion bill to bring back the Roe v. Wade status of a woman's right to choose here in the state of Ohio. But the Republicans are very smart at branding. You know that better than anybody. They're great at getting the message out.
And muddying the water of the message. Like you just said,
exactly.
They made the message confusing specifically so people would, because no, you know, it's easy to get people to vote against their interests when you keep hammering them with enough repetition.
Exactly. And, you know, as soon as, you know, the more you repeat that lie, the more it becomes the truth. But also, you mentioned something about, you know, Iowa being someone who has Iowa kin. You mentioned Iowa, how they stopped voting Democratic because the jobs were gone and everything, and there's no interest in doing anything for people. I remember about, oh, I want to say 14 years ago, I went back to Logan, Iowa. My wife and I went back to Logan, Iowa with my mother and my dad for my dad's 40th class reunion. And going across Iowa, we had to go from Northeast Ohio all the way to Southwest Iowa, pretty much Omaha, Nebraska. And the whole way there, we kept seeing windmills on the farms.
Yep.
and you just kept seeing that from the beginning of Iowa all the way to the end. And that would have been at the beginning of it would have been around the middle of Chuck Colver's term in office, because he was the one he was the first Democrat to succeed a Democrat, Tom Vilsack. And I remember my dad saying, you know, all those windmills out there, the Timken Company, meaning where my dad worked in Canton, Ohio, they are the ones who provided the roller bearings for those windmills so that they can work. So at least there were some American jobs there, union jobs actually being done to bring about alternative sources of energy. And then you were talking about the idea of factories and everything. I remember, and it wasn't that long ago, like my dad's company, the Timken Company, they were having 3 8-hour shifts humming every day. I mean, you go by that factory any time of the day, and that factory was humming. And I can remember back in 96, my dad working, he had the option to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. He didn't do it except a few times a month, because he didn't think it was worth losing time with the family too. But I remember one summer afternoon in 1996, my dad coming home from work on a Saturday and running into one of our neighbors who was a Lutheran minister. And my dad knew this guy was a Republican. So he happened to stop my dad on the way home because he was outside. And he asked my dad, so how's it going? How's it going? And he goes, oh, I'm just working all the time. I think I might have to vote Republican just to get a day off, just to kind of get the idea, just kind of get this guy's nerve up. And he said, the minister says, well, you know, if you do vote Republican, you might get more days off than you really want. So,
boy, he got that right. He got all the days off.
Well, no, he didn't get any days off. Unfortunately, he was able to retire at 58, because that contract at the age of 58 was a much better one that he could retire under. And he's been retired since 2009.
Yeah,
so.
My point was, didn't they close most of that down?
They closed most of it down after he retired. But as long as they're paying his pension, you know, basically like my mother's. Well, here's another thing about Timken, too. Did you know that if you were a male in the union and you wanted to retire, you'd have to get your wife's permission to retire?
Yeah, that's old school stuff.
Right. In fact, my dad had to go get my mom's permission in order to retire back in 2009 so that he could retire under the better contract. So like my mother's one uncle, who also was a Timken employee, said, Mr. Timken works for me now. I don't work for Mr. Timken.
Yeah, but you made Mr. Timken a whole lot of money.
Exactly. And people who work for Timken, they still vote Republican anymore. Your rank and file union members are still voting Republican for, again, because, you know, like you said, muddies the water.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is, while we're going through this Trump garbage, we need to hammer away as much as we can all the accomplishments of Joe Biden. Because once this Trump stuff gets into really fast frenzy, we're not going to hear anything good about what Joe Biden's doing for the people.
Yeah, I plan on not getting into the horse race. There are enough places for the horse race to happen. I'm going to comment a little bit on it, but I've decided that I'm not going to focus as much attention on it. It's going to work itself out.
And the unfortunate part is, though, while you're going to do that, the unfortunate part is you're not really considered mainstream media. That's the problem. It's going to be that mainstream media that's going to do the whole thing, and less people are going to hear what you're saying, which is the important stuff, and therefore it's just, somehow we got to penetrate this bubble. We really got to penetrate this and pop it. And, you know, do like what Harry Truman said. If you benefited from the Democratic Party and you're in labor and you don't do your duty by voting for the Democratic Party, you are the most ungrateful human being this country has ever produced.
There you go. Kurt, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
No, you know, the reality is that what Kurt talked about there is, it was the lives of virtually every working person of that era. You know, and look, you know, everyone, you know, my age and older, you know, they knew those people. And that's what my, you know, I go back to, and that proves, you know, it makes my point even stronger, that, you know, my family, they're the basket of deplorables. It's how they, it's the environment they came up in. but it was those union jobs that they lost. It was that security, those wages, those benefits, those opportunities for themselves and their families. That's what people want back. So if Democrats do anything, start hammering on that. Start hammering on making lives better. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I'm still hung up on this Fareed Zakaria piece. The idea that, you know, there's widespread belief that, all the jobs that were lost were because they went to China. Widespread belief. Yeah, and it's this line just I can't get this. In fact, I put it in red. That's how accurate. It's increasingly clear that the challenge of China has been overcome. It's overcome. We've beat it. It's going to be great from now forward. Oh, geez, Louise. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on did we is the China shock over? I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, always happy to come on.
So there is widespread belief, Scott, that the trade with China resulted in deindustrialization in significant parts of the U.S. It's widely believed.
Widely. Yeah, that's a generous use of the term when he's talking about two or three economist friends he knows who never believed the China shock happened really in the first place. So it's maybe Fareed Zakaria and his buddies who hang out, you know, in these salons, Rick, you know, in the fancy clubs and have not been to these communities in the Midwest or anywhere else. They can believe this all they want, or they can point and say, hey, look, the unemployment rate's pretty low. But when you get down to the community level, you understand that, you know, prosperity's been replaced by the dollar store, and the factory's been replaced by the warehouse, and the unionized factory jobs got decimated at a greater level. And you're not, you know, maybe getting that replacement income that you need. And then that has a ripple effect all over the community. It affects the tax base. Honestly, it affects the divorce rate. I mean, we know that from hardcore research that is done by Nobel Prize winning economists from Princeton, who I think would disagree with Fareed Zakaria on this. But hey, we'll let him have his opinion and his CNN show. But he would be well served, I think, by spending a little time in the communities that where I know you have been, Rick, and where I was raised and where I spent a lot of time as well, because China shock ain't over, still going on. And in a lot of ways, we're still recovering, whether it's supply chains or wages or jobs. And the job is not done.
No, and it's going to get worse. And this is the part that's infuriating, Scott, because, you know, I don't know about you, but I see Team U everywhere. I see, you know, there was a story. What was it? Was it the other day? Or is it today or the other day about China bringing electric vehicles into Europe and basically flooding their markets? And hey, get ready, because they're probably going to try and come here too.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about the jobs of the future. Sorry, you can't have the jobs of the future when you're competing with exploitable labor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 100% correct. Is that the problems in some ways they have evolved. Right. I mean, they aren't the same problems as we started out with 20 years ago. In many ways, they're more widespread, more sophisticated. And now it's not only that we're losing manufacturing jobs, but we've lost intellectual property. We've built up an industry in China of electric vehicles that's going to come and swamp the United States if we're not very careful. And we know that we have given over the keys to many critical sectors of our economy. Like take medicine, for example. Like we didn't have medicine shortages 20, 30 years ago when we had more of the productive capacity here. We see them all the time now. And part of the reason is because it's been offshore. And China is like the single source for a lot of forms of critical medicines, including antibiotics. And we got to be really concerned about that. And yeah, so I agree for all of those reasons that you articulate, that we are a long way of being done with the China shock. And so, you know, we aren't shedding tons of manufacturing jobs anymore. That is true. That is true. But the nature of the jobs has changed. More are probably at risk today than they were. And we're having a harder time digging out of it. And it's creating all sorts of other challenges. And so it's a terrible analysis, terrible take by Fareed Zakaria. I was telling you just before I went on air that I was in a hotel, like getting some breakfast, and I saw him talking about this on the screen. And I nearly dropped my cereal bowl. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, this is not how it looks, you know, out my window when I'm traveling in communities in the Midwest. So, but he just doesn't get there. He doesn't understand.
And this is why, again, I go back to that Wall Street Journal piece, how Democrats lost Iowa. It's this kind of talk. It's this kind of elitism that working people go, they don't care about me. Because right. I went through a lot of these communities where the biggest employer was the drug rehab center, the Dollar General store is the only store in town, where all of the storefronts on Main Street are boarded up. I went through those places, and it's because the factory left, and it didn't leave because it had to. It left because it was seeking more profit for the 1%, for the shareholders, for the wealth class of this country, who decided, screw these poor people, screw these working people. We want more for us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the remarkable thing about this now, I think, is that I think many, not all, but I think many national Democrats have awoken to this, right? And they realize it's a challenge, and they realize it's a political challenge. But more than that, honestly, they realize it's an economic and a policy challenge. And so there has been this response. And it would have been easy for Biden to just dump the Trump tariffs and say, I'm going to go back to being free trade. And he didn't. He did not. And he got hammered by people like Fareed Zakaria, by the way, for taking a tougher line on trade. And in fact, in many ways, making it a more sophisticated line, because he was able to enlist some European allies to try to take on China as well, which Trump was never able to do. And on top of that, you know, it's not only, you know, tariffs alone aren't going to bring jobs back. You have to invest in our own economy. And he's done that to the tune of trillions of dollars to try to bring some manufacturing back to the United States that's going to also have climate benefits and benefits for our infrastructure. Yeah. And we are starting to see the fruits of that. It's pretty awesome. So, you know what? It is not too late for a lot of these communities, but it's going to take, you know, 3-5 years for this to fully come online. And to see that prosperity start to return to a lot of the communities where it's been lost for, 20 years now.
Yeah, I mean, Zakaria makes the argument that China's got some problems, and they do. But so do we. And they're investing in the new technologies and the new energy supply of the future. You know, someone sent me a graph of all of the, wind and solar and hydropower and other renewables, and how much China's, how many gigawatts China's producing compared to the U.S. And over the last 4 or 5 years, they're off into the 140 gigawatt area, where we're still down in the 40s. Yeah. And look, Europe's not much better. India's worse. China's leading the way in all this and creating those jobs. And, a minute ago we had a caller say, he went across Iowa, saw the windmills. All that stuff should have been made here. The steel, absolutely, the bearings that were made in Timken, all of that stuff could have been jobs here.
Yeah. And that was the missed opportunity in terms of deploying this. And fortunately, with the clean energy manufacturing money that this administration is administering, there are Buy America requirements attached to it. So, Sometimes they're phased in because we literally had no capacity on some of this stuff because it had all been offshored. But it will be there for things like solar panels and many of the wind components that we're going to need, because we are going to need those jobs. Right? I mean, you know, someone's going to be making these things. It should be us. Yeah. And it should be those people in communities that lost their jobs to this very real China shock.
Yeah, and the thing is, though, what I hear from my friends on the right is, well, you know, we can't bring those jobs back because nobody wants to do those jobs.
Yeah, well, that is not true. I mean, the problem that, you know, a lot of those folks, as well as like employers who say, I can't find anybody to do X, Y, Z. Part of it is this disconnect between expectations on wages, which I think are very important. Number one. Number two. Part of it is confusion about who's responsible for the training. And a lot of times the employers want to offload that and say, well, you got to figure it out. When in the past, you know, it's been the employer.
Yeah, because you're there for the employer's benefit.
Yeah.
You're making money for the employer. I mean, this is the part that gets me. And I've been struggling with for years that the employers are saying, no, we want government training programs. We want you to go on, pay for your own training. You know, I guess I'm old enough to remember where you could get a job in the mail room and you could get a job, you know, sweeping the warehouse floor. You could get a job doing something on the ground level and they would train you to do the next job next job. And when an opening came in, they say, hey, we're going to move you over there and we'll show you. That's how it used to be. Not anymore.
Amen to that. And here's the thing, and I know this will resonate with you. It is not coincidental that the decline of unionization in manufacturing, mostly due to offshoring, but also due to terrible laws that have been put into place and migration from the north to the south of some manufacturing, that, you know, at the same time that was happening, employers were saying, well, it's harder for me to find this person or that person. When in fact, and I think this is important, you know, unionized manufacturing workforces have an easier time filling those jobs, filling that pipeline, and building that prosperity. And the best examples that we see around the country of this are where you have those union partnerships with the employers to bring people in, to get those skills, and to move them up on that ladder. And so it is a tried and true method, but unfortunately, way less than 10% of manufacturing is represented by a union right now. And so that's part of the solution, though.
No, this is what corporate America has done masterfully. They've gone and, you know, you think the Powell memo forward, they've gone and they've destroyed organized labor and been very effective at it through laws, through defiance, through breaking the law themselves, all of this stuff. And now we got to start over again, which is why I'm so thrilled to see that there's a lot of labor activity going on right now and people fighting the right fights. Yeah. I look at the SAG-AFTRA workers and the writers who, you know, literally are, you know, it's not about wages and benefits. It's about their existence. It's about, you know, them being around. It's about AI taking not just their jobs, but their images and their likeness and using them forever. I mean, this is a real true fight of this moment.
Right. Yeah, it is. And so, you know, and I'm just going to say, in general, for a change, this administration isn't tipping the scale the other way. In fact, it's speaking out on many occasions for workers' rights, which I think is very important, and that helps. And, you know, this is the perfect example of public policy meeting collective bargaining. The steelworker victory in the South with the Bluebird buses, you know, obviously that was won through hard organizing, and that is the primary reason. But a secondary reason is because of Buy America rules, and that if Bluebird wants to sell buses the entities are getting federal money for that, they have to be made in America. So Bluebird couldn't use the threat, we're going to move these offshore, you know, if you do this. They can't, because their business model is built on those sales that involve public investing. So that's a case where Buy America helped to ensure that there, you know, that there was a victory there. And I, you know, I think that we got to see that all over the country.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to finish on this point, because this is really important, because we talk about Buy American, you know, all the time, and how Buy American works. You sent me an article, you know, saying, look, in Wisconsin, 200 new jobs are going to be there at Nokia because they're moving production to the U.S. because they understand, you know, there's benefits to making it here. Not just the jobs and the good PR, but there's benefits to this. And this is where smart industrial policy comes into play, where Trump talked a lot about it, did nothing. We got a guy who's not saying much, but actually doing the job.
Yeah. This is a perfect example, because, you know, Huawei and Nokia are two of the leading broadband providers. Trump did ban Huawei. He wanted to do that. Biden continued that. But that doesn't mean that our telecom equipment is going to come from the United States. But the Buy America laws that were attached to the broadband money in the infrastructure, that did. And that is why Nokia brought those jobs to Wisconsin, because of that Made in America requirement that Biden and Harris and a lot of congressional supporters put into place. But that's Buy America creating good jobs in America. And I think that's what good policy is all about, Rick.
Yep. And it's about time. I mean, honestly, yeah. Something I've been screaming about. We're going on our 18th anniversary coming up here in a couple of weeks, and this is one of the first topics I was talking about. So finally, it only took me 18 years to get us here, but we're going in that direction.
I feel the same way, man.
But Scott, as always, I appreciate the good stuff. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Check out the work that they do there. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the day that two tailors who were out on strike in New York City were killed in a confrontation with the police. It is thought that they were the first workers to die while participating in a strike in the United States. They certainly would not be the last. The United States has one of the bloodiest labor histories of any industrial nation. It's estimated that at least 700 people have lost their lives to violence during a strike. The vast majority of those slain were workers. Some of the most bloody conflicts included the Great Upheaval of 1877, where across the country, 100 workers lost their lives in an uprising of railway labor. Then, in 1892, the strike against Carnegie Steel in Homestead, Pennsylvania, 9 strikers and 3 Pinkerton agents died. 2 years later, 30 workers died across the country in a boycott and strike against the Pullman Palace Car Company. One of the most infamous labor massacres occurred in Ludlow, Colorado in 1914. During this coal mining strike, gun thugs hired by the company rained machine gun bullets and fire down on a tent colony of striking workers. At least 19 people were killed. 11 of them were children. In 1937, 10 workers died on Memorial Day at a demonstration against Republic Steel in Chicago. These are just some of the battles, massacres, and murders that shaped the American labor movement. Too often, the toil of this bloodshed is not taught in history classes. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So yesterday we talked about the AFL-CIO's Executive Pay Watch report. And not surprising, our CEOs are quite well-fed. Our CEOs are well-heeled, wealthy. They, you know, their cupboards aren't bare. In fact, they point out that the average S&P 500 CEO to worker pay in 2022 was 272 times. That means whatever you made working for one of these companies, the guy at the top made 272 bucks for every dollar that you made. And I got to tell you, I know some of these people. I don't think they're worth it. I don't think they're worth it. The average compensation for an S&P 500 company CEO in 2022 was $16.7 million. You know, if we had a tax code that said, you know, anything over, you know, we'll say $10 million gets taxed at 92%, I think you'd see those numbers come down. The amount of the average S&P 500 CEO's pay has increased $5 million in the last decade. So they've gotten a sizable raise, wouldn't you say? In fact, over that same period of time, what has happened is a lot of these companies have seen their dividends, their indexes fall 18%. So that whole idea of a meritocracy, you know, they're getting results, Rick. You know, they earn what they get. Not so much. And the reason I bring this up is I was watching a report about Sean Fain. He's the new president of the Auto Workers Union, the UAW, and they've got a lot of demands. And I've had a couple people email me, go, you know, I think he's, you know, he's out of his mind. You know, he's asking for too much. And it goes to show, it's one of these things that goes to show that we as working people undervalue ourselves. That we, evidently, we don't think we're worth very much. Because what Fain is doing, and I find this to finally someone is taking this, something I've been screaming about for a while. He's saying, he's going in front of those executives and saying, we want a 40% pay increase over the next 4 years. And people are, 40% pay increase? How's that? Where does he get that number from? You want to take a guess? Take a wild guess. Where do you think that 40% number over 4 years comes from? I'll make it easy for you. That's how much the executives in pay has increased over the last 4 years. So he's only going, look, you paid yourself 40% increase over 4 years. Why aren't you willing to pay the people who actually do the work the same increase? Because we used to do this. This used to happen. And I know it's hard to remember. It's hard to fathom that workers would have this kind of power to demand that they get paid better. I know it's hard. But I've been saying this for years. I want to sit down across from these CEOs who are making, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times. What was Live Nation CEO makes 5,000 times what the workers are making? And you go, I want to sit down across from that person and go, explain to me why this nickel you're trying to squeeze out of these workers, why you won't share that. I know. You need more for yourself. I got to tell you, I don't think anyone's worth $16 million a year. Just don't. At a certain point, if you're sitting down across from these CEOs who are making the kind of money that they're making, and then them denying your workers 21, 22 bucks an hour. Are you freaking kidding me? And this is something that as society, as all of us, because if we want, once we realize our power, once we realize that collectively, all of us together, we can demand better opportunities for ourselves and our families. We can do that. Question is, will we? Now, I have some great hope. I see young people, you know, a lot of energy, a lot of activity, but it's not turned into political victories yet. This has to be political victories along with the marching in the streets. Because the big boom in unionization rates didn't happen because of organizing alone. It happened because they got good legislation passed that made it much easier for the good work they were doing on the ground to become positive work to make lives better. And this has to be one of those moments. And, you know, as I've said before, I like Joe Biden. I like him for the reason that, guess what? He's talking about making people's lives better. That is a big freaking deal. And it's a big deal for me. You know, when Joe Biden said that, when I say every job in America should be a good paying job that includes a free and fair choice to join a union, I meant it. That's what I like hearing out of a president. Because as I've said, you know, there were lots of jobs in the 1880s and 1890s, a lot of factory jobs. There was a lot of industrial employment in the tens and in the early 20s, lots of it. Didn't pay anything. It was dangerous. Lots of mining jobs, dangerous. Those jobs became good jobs when they became union jobs. When people were saying, we're going to share in the profits that our labor creates. And we don't work in mines or in factories much anymore, but it's that mentality of our labor is worth something. We are worth something. We are valuable. Our time is valuable. And when we come up to that, when we come around to that idea, maybe we'll get what we earn. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Bidenomics. Inflation at its lowest level in more than 2 years. Unemployment rate below 4% for over a year and a half, longest stretch in 50 years. Share of working age Americans who have jobs at a 20-year high. 13.4 million jobs created. It seems like we're going in the right direction. Now what we do is we organize those jobs and make sure that those jobs pay a living wage so that people can afford to not have two or three jobs. I still remember George W. Bush, a woman goes, you know, I have three jobs. And he goes, wow, that's great. That's uniquely American. It's great that you do that. And I don't think that's not where the woman was going. The woman was going, look, I work three jobs because I have to. I have to make ends meet. And he's like, no, that's fabulous. It's great you got three jobs. Everyone should have three jobs. That's what got us into the mess and where we are today. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
I'm insane. Does that sum it up?
Okay. Well, what's on your mind?
What I wanted to say is I believe that the union's coming back, and then also the voters starting to turn out like in Ohio. I think what's going on is people, and I'm not talking about the extreme right wing, people are starting to wake up and they're going, you know what, wait a minute here. I think I'm just a little bit tired of, you know, your religious beliefs being pushed down my throat or your erroneous economic policies being shoved on the rest of us. And I really do. I think people are starting to pay attention. The people in the middle are starting to pay attention. Because, you know, for the most part, most of us, you know, you have your extreme, your two extremes, and then most people in the middle, we really don't pay attention unless something really bad is going on. And I think that people are starting to go, well, you know, wait a minute here. What did I hear? Because social media, though it can be bad, it can also be good because we're more exposed. You know, we don't pay attention to the newspapers anymore, and we don't watch the news like my dad did when I was a kid. But people are able to share stories more. So I really think that the people in the middle are starting to pay attention.
I think you're right. I just hope it turns into electoral victories. I appreciate the thoughts, though. Thank you.
Have a good evening.
And to highlight that, and I'm glad she brought that up, because, you know, I've been seeing on social media, and this fits right into where I wanted to go. On social media, I've been seeing a lot of people around my age you know, whose kids are now entering the workforce, getting out of college. You know, they're trying to find places to live. They're trying to pay their bills, and they're struggling. They're struggling to find jobs. And the question of what happened to the American dream has popped up. And the thing is you've got all these people, you know, asking, why are my kids struggling much harder than I did? And look, when we were younger, we struggled. It's, you know, everyone admits that. You know, it's different today. You know, when I started at the job, you started at the bottom, and you knew that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you stuck it out, you'd get some seniority, you'd move ahead, you'd get that promotion. There was some loyalty there from the company to help move you along. Now it's just about churning people out. It's now just using and abusing and getting them to work as gig workers and trying to screw them in every way possible. So what you end up having is these people who are, you know, overeducated with lots of, you know, paper degrees who are still living in their parents' houses or not able to pay their rent and their student loan bills. And look, I worry about my kids' future. You know, what jobs are going to be here in 20 years? I think about the kid that's growing up in the place in the housing project that I grew up. What opportunities is that kid going to have to at least have the same opportunities that I did? And I know we talk about the American dream a lot. We talk about the idea that, you know, hey, you know, in this country, in America, if you're willing to work hard, you can have success, that you can have upward mobility. You just got to work hard enough. You can have prosperity if you just work hard enough. And we've internalized it, and people are out there working their butts off. You know, hard work, determination, equal opportunities, yes. And we've internalized this to believe that, yeah, it's our birthright. And the sad reality is the gap between the rich and poor just keep getting bigger and bigger. We've got massive income inequality. And again, it's back to the reason that we've talked about it numerous times. The fact that union density is almost at the level it was when it was illegal. Social mobility has pretty much stopped. Studies have shown that whatever class you were born into, whatever rung on the socioeconomic ladder you were born onto, probably where you're going to stay, maybe even fall a little bit. And then you throw in the rising cost of the inflation, the rising cost of housing, healthcare, education, you name it. People are struggling. And then on top of that, massive student loan debt. And you go, that American dream we were all sold sounds a lot like a nightmare for some people. And I go back to, you know, I was able to live off of a generation that had a vision for the future. They demanded a fair share of the wealth that their labor created in the workplace. And it showed, you know, there are a bunch of great graphs out there that show, you know, from the end of World War II until the mid-1970s, as productivity, you know, skyrocketed, wages went up with it at the equal rate. Workers got a share, you know, it was actually a meritocracy. They got the same share of wealth that they created, and it worked. And then middle 70s, all the way through towards to now, it's been deadlined. People are actually, you know, making less than my grandparents' generation did. And it's finally now Joe Biden who's saying, look, something's not right. We need an industrial policy that's going to bring those jobs back. And I think Biden's got to do a lot more talking about, and I think he does some of it, but I think there've got to be a lot more stories of him talking about, you know, hey, you know, when the father came home from work and the pride that, you know, hey, you did the job, things are going to be okay. You know, we've got a future here. There's going to be opportunity. That positivity that came out of my grandparents, when they got married, my grandfather came back from the war. They got married for the old fashioned reason. They had to. My aunt, their firstborn, came a little early, as I'm told, you know, the old wives' tale. The first one always comes early. But when they got married, they were living in their car because my grandmother's parents threw her to the curb, and my grandfather was, you know, basically, you know, homeless. because you know they were dirt poor. And from that beginning, got a job. You know, thanks, you know, Franklin Roosevelt for passing the minimum wage. At least got, you know, the quarter an hour. And then got that union job. And my grandfather talked about, you know, getting that job, that it was a tough job shoveling coal off the back of a coal, you know, truck 12, 16 hours a day. But it paid. It paid well. It paid enough to get them a place to stay and then to be able to raise a family. And then, you know, became a truck driver and, you know, all this stuff. And because of that union job, was able to lead a solidly middle class existence. And that's the story of millions of people. So when I see these TikTok videos of mothers going, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know how to tell them anything. They're struggling. And their struggles are real. And this, again, is where I come back to smart policy is how we deal with this stuff. Education policy is how we deal with some of this stuff. Healthcare. And I think Biden's doing what he can in this moment. Look, there's no more legislation going to be passed in this term. Maybe in 2024 when he's reelected. And maybe if you get a Democratic Congress, maybe you get something, you know, to add on to help us move forward even further. But that comes back to us. That comes back to the voters doing what they did today in Ohio, holding Republicans accountable when they overreach. And I say this all the time. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. The unholy marriage of the Republican Party and conservative Democrats brought us the world that we're in. Brought us the struggle of the moment that workers are in. I see things turning around. And this is why we need to come together more than we are and put down the red hat and the blue hat and get that hard hat, and because we've got a lot of rebuilding to do. Just seems like now's the time. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kamala Harris was in Philadelphia talking about prevailing wage. What's that? I know, right? Going to come back with that. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Kamala Harris was in Philadelphia today at the Finishing Trades Institute. It's the place where the building trades teach their apprentices how to do glazer work, how to do drywall installation, painting, you know, build stuff. And the apprenticeship programs are some of the best that you're going to get into. You get paid to learn. You learn a craft that is portable. You can take it with you the rest of your life. But she was there at the Finishing Trades Institute in Philly, talking about prevailing wage and how the administration is going to change the prevailing wage laws back to the way that they used to be, you know, from, you know, the New Deal through right around 1983, when the Reagan administration and, again, conservative, Republican, corporate Democrats, those ilk began attacking prevailing wage. And we've seen the attacks all across this country. There are a number of states, Iowa, oddly enough, being one of them, that went and repealed their state, their baby bacons, their state prevailing wage laws. On the national level, it's called the Davis-Bacon Act. On the state levels, you have prevailing wage laws, or they call them baby bacons, that are just on the state level. And what they say is, look, and this, again, this is very much New Deal, my grandparents' generation thinking, and it's not wrong. It's actually smart policy. It's saying, look, if we're going to use tax dollars to build a road, to build a bridge, to build a school, to build a hospital, to build, you know, to build anything, whatever we, the citizens, need, whatever procurement our tax dollars are going to pursue, we should be pursuing high road employment. We should be ensuring that the people who are doing those jobs have some decent wages, have decent benefits, have good working conditions, stability, you know, all that stuff. And she was in Philly today to say, look, we're going to move back to that era. And what's interesting to me is how little we know about prevailing wage. And this is one of those things that I remember years ago, I was giving a presentation to the building trades. And I got in trouble for it because what they heard and what I said were two completely different things. I said, look, you know, there are people out there who are rallying against prevailing wage, who are, you know, holding these demonstrations against prevailing wage. And in the media, everyone is saying, look, you know, it must be bad because there are people out there who are against it. And, you know, our voice is one of the few out in the media structure saying, hey, there's a benefit to this. In states that have done away with their prevailing wage laws, think Iowa, think West Virginia. Oddly enough, West Virginia, their Republican governor, Jim Justice, who did both, passed the whole no rights at work thing, no right to work law, and repealed prevailing wage. Came out not too long after and said, hey, we did all that. Didn't help. We were told it was going to be the panacea. It was going to bring us jobs. It was going to be fabulous. And it made things worse. And there's a definitive study on this that was done years ago about Iowa, where when they did away with their prevailing wage laws back in, I think it was back in the 80s, what they found was that the people who were in the building trades were sufficiently talented enough to find other jobs. So as the wages went down in those jobs, they were able to find other employment, start their own businesses, you know, find other employment. And what happened then is you ended up getting transients coming through. You would get, you know, fly-by-night transient, you know, contractors to come through, and, you know, they would underbid things, and they would do a shoddy half-you-know-what job and take off. And here you're left with this halfway done monstrosity that you overpaid for because you had to pay somebody to come in and do it right. And you still don't have a local building trades because all those people left. And that had played out in a number of other places. That's been kind of the reality of what we know. You have these skilled craftspeople who are like, you know what, if I'm not making a good living doing this, I'll go do something else because I have the opportunity to do that. And then you get these contractors like, well, I got to get anybody. So, hey, let's get that crew that, you know, I don't know what they build, but they'll slap something together. And as I've always said, I want the person building the school that my kid is, that my kid's sitting at, I want that person who's building that, I want that person's kid sitting next to mine. Because I'll know the roof was put on right. I want to know that the people who do this work have a vested interest in it being done the best possible way. Now, whenever I talk about prevailing wage and also project labor agreements, I can't talk about any of it without the tale of two bridges. And for those who have never heard this, the reality is you've got two bridges, one on each coast. You've got the Tappan Zee in New York, and you've got the Bay Bridge in California. The Bay Bridge, they thought was going to cost like $250 million a number of years ago, actually ended up costing something like $6.5 billion. Yeah, that's a big difference. And it's actually, from what I understand, never going to be actually completed. It's never going to be done because it keeps breaking. Things, you know, the Chinese steel that they use, the Chinese cables, the Chinese welders, because they didn't use prevailing wage or project labor agreement. They went and they thought, we're going to get cheaper labor. We're going to be able to cut corners and bring in these shoddy contractors who did shoddy work. Now, you go to the New York Bridge, the Tappan Zee, which was all done under a project labor agreement, all with prevailing wage labor, done not just on time, but early, and not just on budget, but under budget. And done, actually done. And a very beautiful bridge. I've been over it a couple of times. Very, very much better than the old Tappan Zee, which was actually on wooden floats that were rotting. Did not give me great confidence going over that bridge. But this is the difference in what you get. So now you've got the administration saying, we're going to go back and we're going to strengthen these prevailing wage laws to ensure that workers get a fair shake, get a raise, and that we attract the best people into these jobs. Now, I've had people say, but Rick, you know, those are the prevailing wage, that's just a union wage. And you go, no, it's the prevailing wage. It's the wage most often paid in that area for that job. You got 10 people working at the same job, and six of them are making $9 an hour, and two are making three, and two are making seven. The prevailing wage is $9 an hour. So if you're going to do that job on a federal contract, everyone gets paid $9 an hour to do that job. This is how you end up raising the wages. And I've talked to non-union contractors and non-union labor, and they love prevailing wage jobs. Only one problem with them, and this I've heard this over and over and over again. All of these guys who work in construction love prevailing wage jobs because they get paid better. They get benefits. They get health care and retirement money. They get all this stuff. It's great. Problem is you get these contractors who screw them out of prevailing wage, misclassify them, and then pocket the money themselves. Which is why one of the knocks against prevailing wages is its lack of enforcement. The unions do what they can, and they police it as best they can. They do a good job doing it. But there's always someone out there trying to cheat working people. And this is where the Biden administration is saying, we're going to streamline some of this. We're going to make it easier to make sure that people don't get cheated. And that we're going to make it that the money that we spend, the opportunities that we spend, benefit the community. Now, when the bridge collapsed in California during the earthquake, remember during the World Series, I think it was back in the 90s, there was a bridge that collapsed because there was an earthquake. They rebuilt that bridge fairly quickly. And they did it under a project labor agreement with prevailing wage. Well, what folks did is what the economists did at the time is they followed the money. And the reverberation effect of all of the money that was spent on that prevailing wage project and where it went. And the simple part, the simple line in this is if you pay workers more money, they're going to spend it locally. And that local money will reverberate and help small businesses locally. It's going to help Main Street. They're not out buying stock. They're not out, you know, buying yachts. They're not out buying mansions and vacation homes on the Riviera. They're going to the movies. They're going to the local diner. They're buying flowers for their wives. They're making their lives better, and everyone else in their community. So for me, the fact that the Biden administration is strengthening this, another huge, huge feather in his cap, and why working people really should be supporting Biden in this administration. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Right back with your thoughts, 1-866-416-RICK.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like Vivek Ramaswamy, he has become the first Republican candidate to qualify for the presidential debate, the first RNC committee debate, by signing the pledge. And the pledge is that you will support the party's nominee no matter what. And this is, again, Republicans love pledges, don't they? We'll starve children. We won't do anything on taxes. We won't stop people from getting guns and shooting kids in the schoolyard. But we'll send thoughts and prayers. But Republicans are good at pledges, aren't they? I mean, lots of pledges. I think it's the mentality. I think it's that kind of. I do. I think it gives them some kind of comfort to know that I've signed a pledge. Whereas I'm going, wait a second, I don't think I'm ever going to tell you that I'm never going to sign a pledge that says I'm never going to do something. Or that I'm absolutely going to do something. I would never do that. And this pledge, you're gonna have to, if you want to debate, you want to be one of us, you want to be in the club, you've got to sign on that you will support the nominee. Well, what if it is Trump? Because understand, Trump is whipping everyone's behind. There's no one even close. And Trump would be an idiot to go through the debates. Because it's only down for him. He should hold his own event on the night of the debate and mock them for having a debate without him. Because the party is that far gone. And now think of yourself. If you're Chris Christie, are you going to sign a pledge that says, you know, I've been hammering this guy? Yeah, are you Mike Pence? This is the guy that wanted me hung. I'm going to pledge to support the guy that wanted me to be hung. Are you freaking kidding me? But that's Republicans. They love their pledges. You know, it's like the tax thing, and they stuck to them, didn't they? The one thing I give George H.W. Bush credit for was not an H.W. fan. There are only two things I agreed with him on. I don't like broccoli and raising taxes when he had to. When he looked at the books and he said, oh my gosh, we're running up massive deficits. We should probably pay for our stuff. And then had to go back on his pledge of read my lips, no new taxes, because it was for the good of the country. And he got beaten for it. Lesson learned. And now Republicans understand this. So they give them these no tax pledges, which means, you know, I'm never going to raise taxes ever, 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 ever. Even if we go into, what are we at now? $35, $36 trillion in debt, all because of Republican tax pledges. You can't blame the Republicans for that. Yeah, I can. And I think I just did. Because it's them who moved us from a 70% tax rate all the way down to 28. It's them who said, no, we're going to ensure that the wealth class of this country gets to get all of the spoils, and workers, you can pick up the difference. This is one of those things that's just infuriating to me. Also, Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves is going to be facing Democratic challenger Brandon Presley in the Mississippi governor's race. And I think everyone thought this knew this is where it was going to go. But Tate Reeves, you know, put down two challengers. Presley was unopposed. So we'll see what happens in November. There are some who think that the cousin of Elvis might actually have a chance, that Elvis's cousin may actually have a chance to, you know, be a Democratic governor in Mississippi. Oh, wow. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Let's quick go to the phones. Got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I think you raise a really important point there with regard to how we regard taxes and the need to fund the things that society needs in order to function. And unfortunately, I think, you know, as you pointed out, rightfully so, the Republican Party has adopted this sort of unofficial mantra that at no point is it worthwhile to raise taxes, no matter what we need to do. The fact is that taxes paid for the economic booms that have made this country what it is. You know, or the infrastructure that is necessary, the educational institutions, the healthcare institutions, these things that we paid for through taxes are how we elevated the economy, because it's not a zero-sum game. It's not as if you invest a dollar in infrastructure and therefore you lose a dollar other places. No, you invest a dollar in infrastructure and you get back 10 in productivity. But the Republican mantra seems to be, well, God forbid that we invest in anything, because it's going to cost dollars. And that means we may have to raise somebody's taxes. Now, in the long run, we can't sell the fact that that's going to be beneficial for this society and this country. So instead, we're just going to be opposed to any hikes in taxes, anything other than perhaps needing to fund the military, which the Republican Party is always willing to do. But other than that, yeah, everything else is pretty much off limits. And as a result of which, you know, we've been living by a dream in terms of the things that we really needed to fund, like infrastructure, because we are decades behind and we still haven't passed enough in the way of infrastructure funding to repair and maintain the things that have decayed over many decades of neglect. And that's the problem. And again, this idea that society simply functions magically and without having to invest in anything and to repair anything and to maintain anything is just ridiculous. And we're trying to keep up in a global economy with India and China and so much of the rest of the world. Guess what? It's not 1946 anymore.
No, you know, right.
A lot of the rest of the world is caught up. And that means we have to try and stay competitive. And that means we need to invest in ourselves. But, you know, God forbid that we do that sort of thing.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers did a report, I think it was year before, said $4.8 trillion is what we needed to get even. So the $1.2 trillion that Biden got through on the infrastructure bill, not even close to what we need. A good start, good first step, but not what the American Society of Civil Engineers say we need.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because as we all know, a lot of Americans, they don't leave the country. They don't travel very much. For people like myself who have traveled, and you've seen things like modern airports, you know, that are run on 21st century technology, you realize just how bad our system is.
Yeah.
You know, people come here from other parts, from Asia, from Europe. You know, we don't have high-speed rail. We don't have modern airports. I mean, and things are just falling apart. And, yeah, that's what happens when you don't invest. And instead, you decide that you need to create more and more billionaires and millionaires.
Yeah, I'm not a big Thomas Friedman.
It's going to catch up to you.
I'm not a Thomas Friedman fan by any stretch of the imagination. But he had a great line to emphasize what you're saying. He said he went from Beijing to LAX. And he said it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a shame because, you know, we were once, you know, the cutting edge of advancement, the cutting edge of technology. You know, we were that shining city on a hill that, you know, we thought that was going to last forever. Well, guess what? The rest of the world kept modernizing, and we just kept holding on to what we had built in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And now we're paying for it.
No, you're spot on right. I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Take care.
And look, you know, Steve brings up a whole bunch of really good points, and thank you for validating some of mine. But, you know, as he was talking about, you know, conservatives believing in, you know, magic thinking, you go, well, yeah, that's who they are. You know, the imaginary, the person that's looking down to keep them to be decent human beings, wanting those 10 rules plastered everywhere because they can't remember them. And then the invisible hand of the market that's supposed to, you know, magically do all this stuff, that there's no actual planning into any of this. But even more nefarious than that is their fetish of privatization. And as Steve was talking, I was remembering a conversation I was having with my teenage son, who is coming aware of, politically of where we are and what the future is. He's turning into kind of a gearhead. We're learning to ride motorcycles. He's into cars now. So he's kind of starting to think about, the world that he's going to inherit. And, we were talking about EVs and electric cars and the future of, driving, because, we both we'll go out on the bikes and we'll ride for, an hour or two or three. And he's like, in the future, I don't think we're going to be able to do this. He goes, I fear in the future that, everything's going to be electric. All the cars will be on the grid. The 5G will know everywhere where you are at every moment. And, there won't be any more policemen to pull you over because the car will know if you're speeding. And he has this whole thing laid out that him and his friends talk about of what the future is going to be. Of, look, if I want to do 100 miles an hour on my motorcycle, that I'll be able to do that. But it'll just tell me how much the fine is going to be to do it. And if you want to get to work 10 minutes earlier and you want to, go into the certain lane that's going to let you do 20 miles an hour more, it's going to cost you this much. Now, if you want to obey the traffic signs and deal with the traffic, of course, that will still be, somewhat free. But everything else is going to cost you. And as I was telling him, I go, that is conservative world. That's the world that they envision. Everything is for a profit. Everything is in the hands of a corporate interest, in the hands of someone seeking profit. Because I don't know if they actually believe this or if it's what, their controllers are pushing. But when a handful of people control all of these levers of your life and you're paying them every month, every week, every day, they're going to make a lot of money. And I've often joked about, when we go on vacation, it seems like, the most exercise I get is putting my hand into my pocket and pulling my wallet out. Especially if you go to Florida, which we will not be going to again. DeSantis's Florida is, the cost of, the rental costs have quadrupled over the last couple of years. It's crazy. But, you go there and everything's privatized. You want to go to a public park? It's going to cost you, $8 a head. You want to cross this bridge, it's going to cost you that much. You want to do this, every time you do anything, it's costing you. And he sees this and he understands that's conservative world. That's the future for him. And it's frightening because no one knows if the jobs are going to be able to afford those kind of scenarios. Instead of what my grandparents' generation built, which we had the commons. You had public parks, you had, public parking, you had public transit, you had public hospitals, you had things that the public did for itself through its tax base. You had public swimming pools that didn't cost you an arm and a leg to go to. I remember when I was a kid, it was this is sounding really old, and I'm only 56. It was a quarter to go to the Gunnings pool. Now I think it's like $9 locally. I mean, it's crazy. But it's those things that the community used to do for itself that are now being pushed off. We've got to make a profit because we've got to pay someone. Our transit authorities have been, almost profitized. Our turnpikes, our parking authorities, water and sewer, our prisons. Those things that we used to do for ourselves, now you've got this special interest. And he sees this. And he's going, I don't know that this is the future I want. He goes, but I don't know that we can stop it. So right now, it's that kind of gallows humor where he's just joking about it. But I fear he's not wrong. And the rest of us should be too. So again, it comes back to it's policy stuff. The stuff that really affects our lives, we don't seem to be talking about. You know what we're talking about? We're talking about who's drinking what beer and who's wearing a dress And I don't care on all of those issues. I mean, and I've had these conversations before. I want people to lead their best lives. Don't care. I want people to be able to support their families and lead their best lives. That's where we should be. I don't care what my neighbor is doing. I don't care what the person across the street or across town or across the country. I don't care what they're doing. And we used to think like that as a society. Now everybody seems to be all worried about what everybody else is doing and offended for everybody else. Maybe there's a way forward. I'm not sure. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also going to take your calls, 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1994. President Bill Clinton posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Latino farm worker organizer Cesar Chavez. It is the highest honor granted to civilians. His widow, Helen, accepted the honor on his behalf. Chavez founded the United Farm Workers Union. He dedicated his life to organizing agricultural workers in California. Too often, agricultural workers have not received enough attention from labor leaders, despite their struggles to win better wages and improved conditions for themselves and their families. Chavez was one of the most important Latino labor organizers in U.S. history. In 1968, he helped lead a successful national boycott against California grape growers. The boycott won increased wages for those workers and demonstrated the power of the boycott in farm labor organizing. The medal ceremony was held in the East Room of the White House. United Farm Workers leaders attended the ceremony, including Dolores Huerta, the farm union's co-founder and first vice president. President Clinton's remarks in granting the medal captured the impact and sacrifice of this labor activist. President Clinton said, "The farm workers who labored in the fields and yearned for self-respect and self-sufficiency pinned their hopes on this remarkable man, who with faith and discipline, with soft-spoken humility and amazing inner strength, led a very courageous life, and in doing so, brought dignity to the lives of so many others, and provided for us an inspiration for the rest of our nation's history." In his life, Cesar Chavez never made more than $5,000 a year. And yet, the richness of his life and legacy left a lasting imprint on the cause of labor. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Show.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the way it's looking, it looks like a 70-30 blowout. If that's what I'm looking at, that seems really high on the results in Ohio. That's got to be really high. that does seem kind of high. No, the reality is I was pretty sure it was going to go down. And a lot, because the hypocrisy, the hypocrisy of no, we're going to ban special elections, but oh, this one's so important. Now, the abortion issue again is I hate to say popular, but the number of people who I think are like me, I think most people. And this is where I'm gonna put this. I think most people are like me. I don't necessarily favor abortion. It's not something that I think is a good thing. But I want it safe and legal. I never want my daughters in a position to where they're in a back room alley or you know who knows where, and end up getting sick or end up getting an infection, and then they can't go to the doctor to get care because, and then they end up getting an infection, and horrible things happen. We've seen the history of this. I think most people are in this safe and legal. I don't say I'm pro-abortion or anti. I say I'm pro-safety. I want people to be safe. And I've always said that conservatives, if you were really against the idea of abortion, you should make it much better to bring children into this world. You should make it easier. You should make you know, parents have better opportunities to get health care, to get education, to get child care. You should be pushing policies. And we're in this moment where, again, me as a policy person who believes, you know, good policy makes people's lives better, bad policy makes people's lives worse. Because ultimately, government decides who gets what. And right now, they're deciding the wealthy get all they want. But for me, I'm looking at this as if conservatives were really pro-life, and I don't cede them that ground. My daughter and I were having this conversation today because she kept saying, you know, the pro-life people. I go, they're not pro-life. They're anti-abortion because they don't care about that kid. They don't give a tinker's damn about that kid when it's popped out. When it takes its first breath, you're on your own, buddy. Start whittling some bootstraps out of that umbilical cord. Because we're going to get no help from us. And look, Iowa is the perfect example. You know, we talked to State Representative Sammy Sheets the other night, and he said, look, you know, they're trying to privatize education. They've privatized Medicaid. They're gutting the SNAP benefits. They're doing all this stuff to make it harder for poor and working class mothers to raise their children. And yet they want to force more people to have children that they can't afford. And the only decision that they're probably the only good decision they're making is by saying, no, I'm not ready to be a parent. And this was one of those things. My daughter and I were sitting at the pool today because I'm rehabbing my knee. And you go, you know, you need a license to get a dog. Anyone can be a parent. And now we're forcing people who wouldn't otherwise want to be parents. Now we're forcing them to be parents. How many bad parents are we creating? Because we're sitting at the pool watching a lot of that going on. And then how much is society going to have to pay for, you know, all of the negative side of the negative consequences that come out of poor parenting? I don't see any of those policies from our Republican friends. And I want them. Look, I don't want people having abortions. I want them to bring children into this world. But I don't want kids brought into the kind of environment I grew up in, to see the kind of violence, to see the kind of poverty, to see the kind of horrible things that I remember as a kid. No one should have to go through that. And policy can make that better. But we don't have Republicans who think that way. Understand, being anti-abortion is not about being pro-child. It's about being anti-mother. This is about controlling women, not helping them. This is about controlling families, not helping them to thrive and survive. So for me, I look at these people pushing this agenda as punitive. I look at them as being, you know, retaliatory. I look at them as being all of the things that not good. And as one woman said to me, you know, how many of them are on the adoption list to take these kids? Not many. So for me, I would love to see some of those policies. So again, back to the drumming that the Republicans took over this. This is popular in the state, and I don't know that it wouldn't have reached the 60 vote threshold anyway. But this again is one of these moments where Republicans are drunk with power in Ohio because they've gerrymandered the state so badly that they don't fear the electorate. They don't fear anybody going to vote them out. I don't know if this will be a wake-up call for them or, you know, if they're going to, you know, who knows what they try next election? Because look, you know, someone, you know, tweeted over to us and said, hey, is this binding? And I'm like, well, I'm not quite sure what binding means. It means that come November, You're only going to need 50% plus one. It doesn't mean that come next August or next who knows when, or even in September, maybe they're going to run another special election. Who knows what these people will do? But for now, the law is in Ohio to amend your constitution. It's 50 plus one. And that is a victory for working people. So as I've said, will the voters of Ohio hold them accountable? I don't know. Don't know. Now, as I said, the Mississippi race is going to be Tate Reeves and Brendan Presley. What I find interesting, and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, that Mississippi election officials moved 161 voting precincts since November of 2022. That's less than a year. Have made 161 changes. And you can thank the U.S. Supreme Court for that, because they would have needed pre-clearance to do all that stuff. So come November, and I'm pulling for Brendan Presley, how much of the shenanigans Republicans have already pulled in that state are gonna harm Presley? We will see. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Be sure to grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll grab ours. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.